Hello and welcome to Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau of Creighton University, your host for today's program. Let's begin as we do every week by taking a brief look at this week, January 26th through the 31st in history. On January 27th, 1967, U.S. astronauts Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were burned to death during a training exercise aboard an Apollo spacecraft. Also on the 27th, but in 1945, Soviet troops liberated the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp, where as many as 12,000 people a day were killed at the height of Nazi power. On January 28, 1986, all seven members of the Challenger crew were killed after the U.S. space shuttle exploded 73 seconds after liftoff. And on January 31, 1949, the first daytime soap opera, These Are My Children, aired on NBC TV. Turning to history in the news, in the wake of the successful launching of the $200 million Titanic, the Florida International Museum in St. Petersburg has created an exhibition on the ill-fated luxury liner. The exhibit, which will be open through May 15th, contains over 300 objects culled from the more than 5,000 recovered from the sunken ship, including love letters, stock certificates, binoculars, a steward's jacket, and fine china. Also in the news, relatives of Meriwether Lewis are hoping to put to rest the mystery surrounding Lewis's death. William Anderson, a great-great-grandson, has asked the National Park Service to allow him to exhume Lewis's remains, which are buried in Meriwether Lewis Park, 7 miles south of Hohenwald, Tennessee, near where he died. Lewis, who with William Clark led the famed expedition through the American West from 1804 to 1806, is generally assumed to have committed suicide. Some, however, believe he was murdered. And similarly, two Texas towns are arguing over the remains of John Wesley Hardin, the gunfighter believed to have killed more than 30 men. Nixon, Texas, is seeking court approval to move the gunfighter's remains from El Paso, where the gunfighter died in 1895 after being shot from behind. Wendell Scott, publisher of the Nixon Weekly newspaper, the Cow Country Courier, says, and I'm quoting, "We've got a pretty spot all picked out overlooking where he used to live. After all," he continues, "Wes Hardin used to live here, married here, and had his children here. The only thing that happened to him in El Paso was that he got shot." Leon Metz, a historian from El Paso and author of a biography of John Wesley Hardin, has suggested, however, that Nixon's motives are less about family than finance. I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of what is shaping up to be one of the top movies of the year. Many, I expect, have either already seen it or tried to see it and were turned away by the crowds the film has attracted. That movie, Amistad, is based on a little-known episode in history beginning in 1839 with the kidnapping and selling into slavery of a group of West African slaves. It's been made into an unforgettable historical drama by Academy Award-winning director Steven Spielberg, and starring veteran actors Morgan Freeman, Nigel Hawthorne, Anthony Hopkins, and Matthew McConaughey, as well as newcomer Jemaine Hunsu. To talk about the film, we're pleased to have with us today the principal historian of that event, the actual historical event, who was involved in the production of the film, Howard Jones. Howard Jones is University Research Professor and Chair of the Department of History at the University of Alabama. He's the author of several books, including Mutiny on the Amistad, originally published in 1987, but revised and reissued in 1997 by Oxford University Press. Mutiny on the Amistad was the November 1997 selection of the Book of the Month Club, the History Book Club, and the Quality Paperbacks Book Club. Welcome, Professor Jones, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Great. Let's start off for the sake of those who maybe couldn't get into the theater. Could you give us just sort of a brief synopsis of the actual historical event upon which the movie's based?
Well, the story really begins in sometime early in 1839 in a place called Mende in West Africa, about 100 miles inside of Sierra Leone. when a young man about 26 years old, whom we call Joseph Sinque, but whose real name was Singbe Pia, was captured by African slave trade merchants and then taken to the coastal area of West Africa, to a place called Lamboko, where he was put into a dungeon and kept there until they somehow got maybe 400, 500, 600 blacks together for purposes of enslaving them. And Sinque and probably 400 or 500 others were put on board a Portuguese slaver, the Decora, and taken on the dreaded Middle Passage from West Africa to the New World. And I say dreaded in the sense that we estimate that about a third of the Africans who were brought in this Middle Passage to the New World died somewhere along the way. We estimate that maybe 10 to 12 million made it to the New World, whether it be the United States, the islands, or South America, which means that probably 14, 15 were perhaps taken from Africa over the course of about 300 or 400 years. But anyway, this is the first time, and as far as I can tell, the only time in history in which a group of blacks captured for purposes of enslavement, brought to the New World, and came eventually to the American courts, won their freedom, and actually returned home over an incredible period of about 3 years. Joseph Sinque did this. This is basically the synopsis. Now, what happens is they were brought into Cuba, where they were, where an interesting situation developed. Slavery was legal on the island, but the slave trade itself was illegal. And Spanish officials just generally looked the other way when they smuggled in cases such as this one from Decora. And they were placed in Havana, where they were then auctioned off. And this is where the story of the Amistad begins, because here is where Sinque and 52 others, including three young children and a boy, maybe 8, 9 years old, the four of them, were bought by two Spaniards, Ruiz and Montez, and they were to be taken from Havana to a couple of plantations about 300 miles away from them, still on the island of Cuba. And along the way, the rumor always was, blacks thought that white people enslaved blacks for purposes of cannibalism. And on the way, Sinque managed through sign language to ask the mulatto cook, Celestino, what's going to happen to us. And Celestino indicated by drawing his finger across his throat that they were going to kill them. And then, since he was in the kitchen already as the cook, he began acting as if he were cutting up meat and then salting it and indicated they were going to be eaten. And this is where Sinque, stunned, somehow made it back to the hold. But before he got back down, he found a nail, hid it under his armpit, and that night conspired with Grabo and others to lead a rebellion. And they were on the Amistad at this point, which had been chartered by the two Spaniards to carry them to this port about 300 miles away. This was July 1st, 2nd of 1839. In the course of the rebellion, which broke out maybe 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, a stormy, stormy, dark morning, they killed the captain. First they killed the cook, I might add, then killed the captain, and then spared the lives of the two Spaniards. The two Spanish sailors aboard, we think, jumped overboard, and since they were around 20 miles from shore, probably drowned because we never heard from them again. The two Spaniards' lives were saved because they were going to be the ones to navigate the vessel back to Africa. And Sinque had it figured out, quite logically. They had sailed out of the sun. They would simply sail back into the sun. Well, the two Spaniards conspired to zigzag through the waters and to try their best to be picked up by a British anti-slave trade patrol. Well, this didn't work, and they eventually inched their way up the North American coast. And after an incredible odyssey of over 60 days, and by this time, around 10 of the original 53 had died, a couple of them perhaps in the rebellion itself, but others from starvation and thirst and drinking contents on board that they thought was good, but it turned out to be something that killed them. 43 of them found themselves off the coast of Long Island, New York. And there they were discovered by a U.S. naval vessel, a captain who captured them all after a very brief skirmish. And his idea was, don't ask any questions about what happened to them. Simply take them to New London, Connecticut, to an admiralty court, where they would receive salvage on the blacks as slaves, as property, because Connecticut, believe it or not, still condoned slavery, even though it was pretty much on its way out and there were very few there, and, of course, on the ship and on anything in the cargo itself. And there the story might have ended, had it not been for a group of people who were considered to be fanatics and on the edge of society and radicals, a group known as the abolitionists, who believed that slavery was a sin and that You don't compensate owners. You simply take the blacks from the slave owners and turn them free, because if you do pay them anything, you're compromising with the devil. And so the abolitionists were regarded as anarchists, upenders of society and so forth, but they had a cause. And they decided they were going to use the Amistad case as a way to expose the evils of slavery, the slave trade, and everything else, with the idea, very much like the civil rights activists of the 1950s, if you're going to get rid of a great wrong in society, the first thing you've got to do is convince the great masses of Americans that indeed there is something wrong in that society. And so many people, according to the activists of the 50s and certainly the abolitionists of this period, had condoned slavery simply by looking the other way. Very few participated in it, but they were all guilty as far as the abolitionists were concerned. And so they wanted to take this before the highest public forum in the land. They needed money to do this, and they found this in the form of Louis Tappan, a wealthy New York businessman, who decided to underwrite what became known as the Amistad Committee, a group of people who were going to look for a lawyer, someone to defend them in court. And they found it in a very outstanding court lawyer named Roger Baldwin from Connecticut. And the argument they would present, starting from day one, was that these were human beings who were kidnapped Africans, who had the inherent right of self-defense, even to the point of killing their captors if they had to. And it didn't matter whether they were black or white, male or female or whatever. They were human beings. And based on the Declaration of Independence and the natural rights of man, they had the right to do this.
Okay, well, let's hold off and not give the audience the answer here, or the ending of what happened in court. But what do you think about historically in everything you've told us so far? Is this a film, and I know you could go on at length here, but briefly, how do you think Spielberg did historically?
I have been reading the arguments of film critics who, I think, nitpick, and some historians, I might add, who quibble over details, and I've tried to turn it the other way, and let's take a look at what he did in a positive sense. And I've used as my guideline, if he got the essential truth of the story across, if he changed a few things for dramatic license but did not disturb the essential story, then I think he's done a fine job, and I think indeed he has done that.
Good.
There are inaccuracies. There is dramatic license, but he has not disturbed the essential story. And we as historians have not managed to get this Amistad story before the American public, and if indeed it takes a Steven Spielberg to do this out of Hollywood, maybe he will create an interest in history. People will find out history is indeed interesting and maybe want to read more about it.
Good. Okay, good point. I agree, having seen it. But let's, just for the sake of conversation, pick one, that, let's say, the most serious lapse, if you will, historically in the film. Anyone you want.
Well, there are three or four. One is the meeting between John Quincy Adams and Cinque. Now, Adams's memoirs reveal that they indeed did meet, but the record does not even begin to suggest that Cinque advised John Quincy Adams on how to present the case before the Supreme Court. It makes for a nice story, but the record does not show this. 1.2, I might add, is that they turn Baldwin inside out. Baldwin, in real life, was already the visionary and the outstanding lawyer, the humanitarian who worked against slavery for practically nothing when the Amistad captives were first brought before him. And the people, Tappan and others, went to him. In the movie, though, Baldwin is seen as an ambulance chaser, a man who is a property man, a cold-hearted real estate man, who grows as he associates with the blacks. And in fact, he has to almost throw himself at Tappan. Now, I don't see that this really does a terrible injustice to the story, because we do end up at the right place when it's over anyway.
Right.
But there are people who are upset about that.
Okay, what about Theodore Jodson? There's been some controversy there about his being a fictional character. This is the part that Morgan Freeman plays.
Well, what Spielberg could have done, and I don't know why they didn't do it, there really was a black abolitionist minister named James Pennington from Hartford who was involved in this that they could have used. But instead they chose, and I see the rationale, I suppose, for it, they chose to create a black person who would be a composite of the blacks in Connecticut. And, of course, the state of Connecticut was about 6% black, and there were, of course, black abolitionists such as Pennington and a few others. But Morgan Freeman, Theodore Jodson, a fictional character, was supposed to represent a composite of all blacks in this period, and that's
okay.
What they did.
Great. Very good. Okay. Well, you're listening to Talking History and an interview with Howard Jones. Welcome back to Talking History and our conversation with Howard Jones about Amistad, the film and history. Well, Howard, I suppose we've got to get the let the listeners off the hook here. Why don't you tell us briefly what the Supreme Court's decision was in this case?
It was really a confirmation of what the lower courts had decided, the district court in particular, and that was that Baldwin's argument was correct. The papers that claimed that the blacks were born in Cuba, that they were legitimately held slaves, the papers were as fraudulent, as openly fraudulent as anything could be. So in technical terms, it is true, as people say who often criticize the decision, that the whole case was decided on a technicality. And Joseph Story handed down the decision, and they were kidnapped Africans with the inherent right of self-defense, the right to go free. Now, one of the important points to note about this, which is often overlooked, is that this was a group of blacks testified in court and won their freedom in antebellum American courts. And not only that, before Roger Taney's court, where there were 5 out of the 9 who were slaveholders or had been at one time or another, Southern sympathizers. This, I think, is amazing in that sense. So it's really the first civil rights case in America's history, I think one can argue with all truth. The other is that Joseph Story handed down the decision, and he hated slavery, but he also recognized that it was legal, and he wasn't about to challenge the law. The only way you do that is through the system. So he wasn't going to make a moral decision on slavery and set them free. But what he did do, and I can't imagine that he did this by accident, because he's a jurist, he's scholarly, he knows how to weigh his words very carefully, knowing how they can be taken to mean almost anything. He said that on the, quote, basis of the, unquote, eternal principles of justice. Now, what he meant by this, they go free because of the inherent right of self-defense. But what the abolitionists did was two things. One, they looked at the words eternal principles of justice, and they equated that with a return to the Declaration of Independence, natural rights. Therefore, slavery has been slammed by the court, and they went free on that basis. And the result is that in terms of PR terms, the image of the case, the bottom line is these blacks went free, and they were turned free by the court on the basis of the eternal principles of justice. And I can't help but believe that Story had to have known that the abolitionists would run with this kind of argument. I know that I read a diary not too long ago at Yale of a young college student, 19 at the time, who was in Farmington, Connecticut, an abolitionist family, and he wrote in his diary, I've just heard that the court has turned them free. And he said, liberty has triumphed, the system has won, justice has reigned. He didn't say a thing about, well, it was on the basis of a technicality. Right. All he saw was the blacks went free, right. And it was a great victory for abolition.
And what did happen to the Africans after the court decision?
The first thing, and this, of course, is overlooked in the movie, they spent another 8 months inside the U.S. because there was no money to take them home. There was no law, no legislation whatsoever that by which the government would finance their return. And so they ended up going to Farmington, Connecticut, where I was not too long ago, a very nice, very wealthy community, a hotbed of abolition and of the Underground Railroad in this period. And they were had a place built for them, and they lived and worked there, and they went on exhibits, and they gave little shows in which they read from the New Testament and sang and did tribal dances and so forth. And they raised enough money so that they were able to charter a vessel, the Gentleman, and return. They left actually in November of 41 from Farmington, and eventually pulled out of New York and made it back into Africa in January of 1842. 35 of the original 53, including all 4 of the children and including Cinque, made it back into Sierra Leone.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to ask you, because I understand that you were actually invited to Hollywood to view the filming of Amistad. What were your thoughts as an historian working with Steven Spielberg?
It was wonderful. I had been called a few times before by their research team for various facts and so forth, so I really had no official connection in that sense. But then one day the phone rang, and it was in the history office, and my secretary said it was DreamWorks, and I thought she was joking, and it turned out it was. And we were invited out, my wife and I, and we had the royal treatment, as you can imagine, and we ended up going to Van Nuys, California, where there was a replica of the Amistad, and they were filming the actual mutiny, so I was able to see them do the mutiny, and that's where we met Steven Spielberg. And I was enormously impressed by his gentlemanliness and by his lack of arrogance and by his lack of pretentiousness. He was at the middle of a huge swarm of people, as you can imagine, and he had an old T-shirt on with a shirt tied around his waist and old gym shoes and faded jeans and a baseball hat. He was everything you could imagine more, and as friendly as can be. And after we had talked for a while, we then sat back, and he was had the ship in front of him and then a monitor between him and the ship, a color monitor, and then we were about 3 feet behind him and watched him shoot the mutiny, and it was just a great experience. And several other times we talked with him, and it was just very impressive. I met both him and Debbie Allen, the producer from Fame and the one who sold the idea to Spielberg, Felicia Rashad's sister, and met Jaimin Hounshou, who plays Sinke in the movie, and met a few of the others, and it was just an unbelievable experience.
Well, that's a great story. We don't hear that very often by historians who get involved with Hollywood, but that's great to hear. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you for joining us, Professor Jones.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Great. Brian. Congratulations on your well-deserved recognition on your work on Amistad, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and I certainly do, too.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Our guest today has been Howard Jones, author of Mutiny on the Amistad, published by Oxford University Press. Those interested in learning more about the Amistad affair would do well to read Howard Jones' book and visit the National Archives and Records Administration website, which contains documents related to the circuit and Supreme Court cases involving the Amistad. Pens ready? This can be found on the Internet at the following site, www.nara.gov/education/teaching/amistad/home.html, all lowercase. And for those who might want to turn their interest into an educational vacation, I would recommend a visit to the Amistad Research Center at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. The Amistad Research Center houses an extensive collection of materials related to the episode as well as to African and African American history. For further information, call the Amistad Research Center at 504-865-5535 or access their homepage on the Internet at www.arc.tulane.edu. Once again, all lowercase. To conclude this week's show, in which we spotlighted the Amistad affair, we have historian Gregory Castor commenting on one of the major figures in that event and film, John Quincy Adams. Professor Castor is an associate professor of history at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. He has titled his commentary, John Quincy Adams, An Example for Our Times.
History can be instructive and often inspiring. Take, for example, the case of the nation's sixth president and arguably its greatest secretary of state, John Quincy Adams, who lived from 1767 to 1848. 150 years after his death, Adams, as played by actor Anthony Hopkins, is now being immortalized on screen in Amistad, Steven Spielberg's cinematic history of the Amistad slave ship revolt, including Adams' defense of the slave mutineers before the Supreme Court in 1841. The film ought to inspire Americans to rediscover and demand of their own leaders the kind of character and courage that defined Adams's distinguished post-presidential career as congressman. Today, the media tend to reduce character to titillating questions about a public figure's veracity and private behavior. For Adams, however, character involved more than rectitude in private life, important though that was to him. It demanded a sober sense of virtuous duty based on religious and political convictions, the duty, above all, to effect mental, moral, and national improvement. Commitment to improvement of self and nation motivated Adams's courageous opposition to slavery during his 17 years in the House of Representatives from 1831 until his death, service that began shortly after his unsuccessful one-term presidency. Most notable was his heroic 8-year fight against the so-called gag rule, adopted by the House in 1836 to prohibit debate of Northern anti-slavery petitions. At issue for Adams, no less than the wrongs of slavery, was the rule violation of the constitutional right of petition. Defying both the letter and spirit of the gag, he presented and discussed anti-slavery petitions, including those signed by disfranchised women and slaves, had the clerk of the House read to members the Declaration of Independence, and denounced defenders of what he called the sin of slavery. He aimed to reverse the rule while arousing public indignation against slavery and the political power of Southern slaveholders. Adams persisted bravely in the face of threatening opposition, including angry calls for his censure, until the gag was finally repealed in 1844. What is so striking and anomalous about Adams's courage from the perspective of our own day is that it was driven by character, principled conviction, and serious study of history, not focus groups or polls. Perhaps equally strange to us, he mixed character and courage with intense political ambition. Adams felt that his election to the presidency was not half so gratifying as his election to the House. Here is a lesson for President Clinton, who should consider repeating Adams's rewarding move from executive to legislative branch. Just as Adams went from thwarted president, relentlessly opposed by Congress, to courageous and effective congressman, so might Clinton following his second term. And who knows, with his Hollywood connections, he may not have to wait as long as Adams to be immortalized by the movies. Meantime, inspired by John Quincy Adams's on-screen example, citizens could do worse than demand of their leaders even a portion of his real-life character and courage.
Once again, you've been listening to Gregory Castor, Associate Professor of History at Gustavus Adolphus College. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, if you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, or topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu, or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.